back, where history comes alive, here with Harry Cooper once a month. And you can, again, participate. All you got to do is buy the books. They're extraordinary. Just amazing. All right, Mr. C, are you ready to go take some calls and see what the folks out there have to say?
Rock and roll.
Okay.
All set here.
We'll go to California first and say hi, and thank you, Mary, for waiting for 25 minutes, 26 minutes now. You're on. How are you? Hello, Mary. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Mary. There you are. Okay.
Hi, Mary. How you doing?
Hey.
This is Harry Cooper.
Hey, Harry Cooper.
Hi.
So, hi. Sort of long-time listener, first caller, but I was wondering if you had any awareness of Patrick Wood, you know, the technocracy stuff, and you know what happened in the World War, right after World War II, where there just became this movement toward, you know, with the trilateral
commission.
Corporation or whatever,
trilateral commission.
Yeah, commission being developed, and it's like the hegemony of all this stuff. And also, you know, I feel so, you know, I'm German descendant, so I watched The Greatest Story Never Told. And
oh, yeah, that's an excellent tape.
Yeah, where it's just the destruction, and I feel so blessed and great that Jeff has been talking about how we've just been, our whole culture has been being decimated by whomever.
Jeff is,
you know,
pretty good at digging into things like that. But as to your question about the hegemony, and all I know about it is what I read. I'm an expert on the U-boats and on Hitler escaping, but the rest of this, I really am not an expert on that. I just know what I read and what I pick up from rents.
Mary, the Trilateral Commission, Bilderbergers and others who weren't quite formed yet, but the entire globalist power structure under the Rothschild banking cartel came together after the war and began to assert itself, led by the Zionist, Bolshevik, communist killers, between 5 and 13 million Germans were murdered after the end of the war from 1945 to 1953. And these people who were killed were the heart of what was remaining of the Reich and Germany, Deutschland über alles. This goes way back. The beginning of the destruction of Germany and its people was World War One, and before that. But World War One was fought to destroy Germany. Germany was then set up to guarantee World War Two, because along came this guy named Hitler. He threw all the Bolshevik communists out and said Germany should be for German people. This is our country, our culture. And he built that country, as you know, into a monument of dedication and devotion by its people. And the world...
And recently, 2008, my friend and former member of Shark Hunters, Jörg Haider, the Austrian strongman, said Austria is for Austrians, and he won a big election in September of 08, and he said he was going to take Austria out of the European Union, going to go off the euro, and kick out all the Middle East freeloaders. 3 weeks later, he was dead. So, I'm sorry I can't answer any more of your question there, Mary, but that's all I know about it.
My fear is that there is this intentional genocide of the white European.
The white race has been marked for termination. You're quite right. There is a war on the Caucasian Americans and Europeans who came here and who are still coming here. You're 100% right. This is the end of the white race as we knew it in Germany, in Europe, and over here.
And then
what's
what
the
is
next,
the solution?
What's the next question?
What is it that we can do? as to you know, I know Agenda 21, blah, 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 where they're trying to do this and that. As far as a solution, what can we do to protect ourselves and sustain ourselves?
It's almost to the point now where I don't mean to be smart alecky, but first of all, you need to get a gun or two, learn how to use it. We're getting to that point. We're not there yet. We may never get there, but you've got to start preparing at home. Help those around you who have an interest in reality. Keep yourself learning. You're well informed, I can tell. Even Churchill in his biography said this was not a war, World War II, against National Socialism, the Nazis. This was a war against Germany and its people, because Germany was walking away from the rest of the world. And the controllers, the Rothschild banksters in the city of London, which is a 2-square-mile sovereign state in London, were not about to have that happen. And so they decided this is the end. Now, white America is under attack here. What can you do? You can't contact your congressman or senator. Forget that. All you can do is arm yourself with knowledge, arm yourself with arms, and try to help those who don't know to understand that they're in great danger. There's something about the white race. It's too kind. It's very gentle, and we give too much, and we've got to stop
that. This might be a topic for a different show.
Gotcha.
Thank
so I don't know anything more about this than anybody
else.
No,
I'm speaking for myself, not for Harry.
Right.
He didn't have anything to do with what I'm saying.
No, I know that. I was just wondering if there was anybody else with a different question.
You bet. We got three more coming. And thank you, Mary, very much for the call.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay, you
Thanks,
take
Mary.
Care.
Bye-bye.
All right. In Canada, Martin has called in. Let's say hello. Martin, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I am, Jeff. Can you hear me?
We got you loud and clear. Harry's here. What's your question?
Well, Jeff, first of all, I want to acknowledge you for the work that you've done and are doing. I've been a longtime listener for many years. And
thank
you. Mr. Cooper, the work that you have done, you know, with Shark Hunters, you know, brings tears to my eyes.
Yeah, it's amazing. He's a real hero, Martin, and I do understand and I agree with you 100%.
I'm originally out of Canada's Arctic, and I grew up with a dog team as a boy.
Ah.
And when you're out on the land, you know, dealing with, you know, the elements and whatnot, you rely on those dogs. Now, we've seen all the pictures and the disinformation campaign vilifying Hitler and all of that, but what's always intrigued me was the way the dogs, the German shepherds or other animals that would come in contact with him, would be so warmed up by his presence. And as an old dog musher, that tells me a lot more than anything that can be written about the man or revealed about the man, is to see how those animals and those dogs reacted. There was a genuine warmth there.
That's a very interesting comment. He also really appreciated the family and children and the whole idea of being a viable force in society. In other words, reaching your potential. He was the first person to launch a war on cancer, on smoking, to promote vegetarianism. There's extraordinary things going on in Germany. Go ahead, Harry.
He also outlawed vivisection in Germany. You know, for those who don't know, vivisection is cutting open animals while they're alive and awake with no medication for pain to see how the inner parts work. And he made that illegal in Germany. And he was a vegetarian, as you say. So he loved kids, and he was not, and I know I'll hear from the spitlickers on this one, but he was not the horrible guy. He grew up.
Well, he was a human being. He was a human being.
Yeah, he sang in a church choir. I was in the church in Austria where he sang in the choir as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, so often the difference between the real person and the image we're told whether it be Hitler, where we're told that the total evil, horrible person, or Eisenhower, who's supposedly a wonderful, great guy, and he was really not. But let's not get off on that tilt on this show. But, you know, you have to be able to separate true fact from the propaganda history, and sometimes that's not easy.
Well, Harry, so, you've done a remarkable job in that respect. And when we talk about the children and their response, and I know there's sensitivities about this question, but what about Hitler's children? And I trust the good folks at Mercedes are doing what they can to look after them. But
that's a gigantic question mark, Martin. We know Hitler had a son from World War One from an affair he had with a hooker, but he died in France, I think, in 1957, something like that. I saw the paperwork and all that pertaining to that at the hotel of my friend Ingrid Scharfenberg. But there are stories, rumors, that Hitler had other children. It's quite possible. We don't know. We don't know. We're still digging into that one. But we just don't know.
You're well informed, Martin. You must have done a lot of reading, research over the years on this.
I've been in a lot of different research, cutting edge and technologies and stuff like that. But the German technology boost that they had from, let's say, cosmic neighborhood friends has always intrigued me, and I've been involved in propulsion systems, energy systems, and that sort of thing. And I believe that there was input in a lot of the German NASA scientists. Mr. Cooper's said that they had help, and you know, there's a lot going on today. And
well, those are the very things that I hope to learn more about before I'm gone. And Harry is working to open every door he can find. Yeah, and there's a lot to come, Martin.
As I said, they had the German nuclear scientist down there, and from the research that I'm learning from the former atomic energy chief, there was a ton of German scientists down there. We knew some of this, Professor Tank, the guy who developed the Focke Wulf FW-190 fighter plane. He came down there with like 50 aeronautical engineers, et cetera. There were scientists. There was a ton of people went to Argentina. Not everybody went to Russia or the U.S. Quite a few went to Argentina, and we're still digging out what they have done. Argentina seemed for a long time to be in constant state of uproar or revolt. This guy didn't like the president, so they mount an army against him, and then the next guy overthrows him. And the records keeping got kind of tough, but through the contacts I have now down in Buenos Aires, including another gentleman, I don't think he wants his name known either, he just translated Hitler in Argentina and also Hitler and the Secret Alliance, translated them into Spanish and also into Portuguese. So we'll be making more contacts through him. I'll be down there probably the whole month of February.
Okay.
Meeting with various different people, including somebody you know also, Jeff. I'll be meeting with Lawrence DeMello down there.
Oh, yeah. Very, very good.
Well, Harry, you mentioned earlier about your interest in Antarctica, and mm-hmm. I really think that would prove quite fruitful. This technology and the level of sophistication that they had then wasn't just something that evaporated. It has its own inherent longevities. With the technology work that I do, you talked about cold fusion. That's now been translated into LENR. Low energy nuclear reactions. All of these
right.
things are becoming reality, including, you know, the ancient art of alchemy, which I'm also involved in. I'm actually a gold making alchemist. But been involved in new energy technology.
I know they were using lithium for the cold fusion rather than tritium or deuterium.
Interesting. Okay, Martin, can we get a final comment? I got a bunch of callers here. I want to try and get them on for a little bit. Great
I'll
questions.
Stay on as long as you can keep the air open.
Well, we'll do it.
Again, just thank you, Jeff, and carry on with the wonderful work that you do.
Thank you, Martin.
Does,
thank you very much.
He does great work, Martin.
Thank you.
And thank you,
thanks,
Harry. You've done it all.
Thank
all
you.
Right. Merry
I'm
Christmas, Martin.
Merry Christmas.
Okay, let's go down to New York, or across to New York, however you look at it, and say hello to Michael. Hello, Michael. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Renz. Good evening, Mr. Cooper. Pleasure to be on your show,
gentlemen. Good evening.
I really
thank you, sir.
Show very much. I have two questions, gentlemen.
Okay,
first
number one.
First question is, during Operation Barbarossa, if Erwin Rommel was in charge of Operation Barbarossa, would that have been a more successful operation to able
okay.
to defeat the Bolsheviks in Russia?
All right. That's number one.
The second question is, if the remaining panzer units were able to return to Berlin, would they have saved Berlin from the fall up to the Russian Red Army?
Okay. Good
well,
questions.
Much as I'm not really that much of an expert on that part, just from what I've read and from what I've talked to from some of the foot soldiers, I don't know if changing the command structure in Barbarossa would have changed much of anything. That was the most bitter winter in 100 years. The German troops had pretty well outrun their supply lines, and the Russians just had almost an infinite number of people. So, excuse me. So if you wipe out 10,000 today, they'll have 20,000 more coming in tomorrow. And pretty much the same answer could hold true about if the panzer divisions had come back to defend Berlin. There just plain weren't enough people. There were only three countries in the Axis. One, Italy was not that big a help. Two, Japan and Germany really never cooperated well. So basically, Germany was the only one fighting the European war, and yet the Allies, I think we counted them once, was 93 countries. Nobody could match the United States in production output, planes, tanks, etc., and nobody could match the Russians for the number of people they wouldn't mind sacrificing. I think it was like 20 million soldiers they lost. So, you know, if you can have the best troops in the world, and I think the people who fought against the Germans will say that the German, especially the Waffen-SS, were the best there were. But, you know, if you're going to get into the ring, for instance, Michael, with the world heavyweight boxer, you're going to get your butt kicked. But if you get into the ring with 90 of your best friends and have a lot of weaponry and everything against the one guy, it doesn't matter how good he is, he doesn't have a prayer. And that's just what it was. Germany was overwhelmed by American manufacturing, for which I have no apology. America was a great country at that time. The American manufacturing, the Russian number of people, you just couldn't stop that. It was just a tide that you couldn't stop.
They had they were producing more fighter planes at the end of the war than they were at any time during the war. They had no pilots. They had no fuel. It was,
yeah, the fuel especially.
Yeah.
And that was something that was, if you're familiar with the famous raids on the Ploesti oil fields, those oil fields were owned by Standard Oil, which is today Exxon. And they had made a deal with the German government to sell them for $23 million worth of gold, and the State Department kept trying to dissuade them, and the bombers kept getting the wrong coordinates. And finally, under Harry Truman, when he was a senator, his subcommittee told Walter C. Teagle and William Stamps Farish of Standard Oil, if you go through with this deal, I'm going to put you in jail. Well, then the bombers got the right directions. They blew up the Ploesti oil fields, which cut about 65% of the German fuel. And then Standard Oil went to the U.S. government and said, hey, you blew up our refineries. You got to pay for them. And the U.S. government did. But that pretty well, that was the first gigantic cut in German fuel supplies. And you're right. They had jet fighters all over the place. They had Arado jet bombers. They had planes all over the place, tanks all over the place, and no fuel to move them. So,
hope that
strangle the supply line.
Yeah, hope that answers your questions, Michael. And the last stand at Berlin is one of the most bravest, selfless, heroic things you could ever see.
One of our members, Baron, what the heck was his last name? He was a bombardier on Heinkel 111, and George von Zurich, that was his name, he said they were flying supply missions at the end of the war, not bombing missions, just dropping supplies to the guys. And he said as they were coming back, he could see the Western Front and the Eastern Front at the same time from his airplane flying at 5,000 feet.
Wow.
And he said the Eastern Front and the Western Front were only a few miles apart, and it was pretty obvious it was all over but the Shelton.
Yeah. Okay, Michael,
thank
you very much for the call. You bet.
Take care.
Okay. Merry Christmas, Michael.
All right. Here's a name that will sound familiar. The name is Reinhold. Reinhold, welcome to the program. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
We do. Thanks for waiting, and to all of our callers, thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Absolutely. First of all, Jeff, thank you for the great service that you have done in uncovering, you know, all these unmentionable things that, you know, we're reexamining everything right now. The truth will prevail, and you're definitely a champion. I want to thank you for all of your diligence on this.
Okay? Thank you very much, Reinhold. I appreciate it greatly.
Absolutely. And then Mr. Cooper.
Yes, sir.
I just got your book. I'm about three quarters of the way through Hitler in Argentina.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for signing the book. I'm reading it very well. I think I told you that I'm a German American, but my father was a submarine person.
Okay.
My father. Yeah. In World War II, you know, he was just a poor little guy in the ghetto in the 1930s during the Depression.
Ah.
And then the SS had a mustering, you know, where they sort you out. They pick
sure.
you and they sort you out. And here was this little guy who went down to the train station, and they kind of passed him by. And then the second
you and I had emails by, about this, didn't we?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I thought I remembered that story.
Yeah. And they went through it again, you know, and they said, submarines. You're good for
yeah, right.
You're a small guy.
Because he's short.
Short, right? And then they made him a cadet. He got his first pair of Oxford shoes from Adolf and a uniform. And then he was sent to the Baltic Sea, where he learned how to sail. He felt like he was a man. He was part of a team. His mother said he stood taller. He had become a full-blown man, and then they'd ask him whether he wanted to join the submarine corps. So he did.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what I'm saying is like that. Your whole fascination with the uncovering who the submarine commanders were, their stories.
Yeah. Well, anybody serving on a submarine, whether American, German, whatever, it's a team. It's the kind of camaraderie that nobody else can know. I'm an Air Force veteran, and you know, we had teamwork, but not like on a submarine that's gone for, depending on the boat, the mission, 2 weeks, anywhere up to 3 months. It's a camaraderie
right.
that can't be understood unless you've been in the boats.
Yes, and you know, my brother and I have been trying to have, you know, debrief my father for hours until late into the night, many times, you know, where my mother said, look, it's time to go to bed, guys, okay? But we were trying to find out, Dad, what really happened? What really happened?
Yeah.
And he basically told us that, you know, the men were basically all involved in building the submarine. Later on, they began to do sort of modules. So the different modules would come together, and then they would, you know, put the sub pieces together.
That was the Type 21 boats. They were built in separate sections and brought together, usually at A.G. Weiser, or as you would say, A.G. Weiser. and put together in sections. That was the Type 23 and Type 21, because the building yards were under such constant bombardment they couldn't build a submarine without having it blown up. What boat did your father serve on?
You know, you asked me that before. I really am not sure. I'm going to check with my brother, who has all the artifacts.
Yeah, because if you can tell me what boat, if you can tell me what boat your father rode, I can tell you the whole history.
That's great. I have some pictures of him also, you know, on that as a cadet on that boat. But I was going to just say this.
His first training was up at Flensburg, I imagine.
Yeah. Yes, it was. Yeah. And he was captured not too far away from there.
Right. And then he would go to probably Gotenhaven, Gdingen for his boat training.
Yes. Yes. I've heard all those stories from him, you know, how they try to drown these submarine guys, you know. They hold them underwater for about 3 or 4 minutes. And if you can survive
that. They also had an escape tower that was, what the hell was it? It was about 90 feet or 100 feet, whatever that is in meters, 33 meters or something, full of water. And the cadet would be down below, and they would pressure lock into the tower, and he would have to ascend using the tow glider and ascend slowly so he didn't blow out his lungs. And that was part of the training. They had the same thing with the American submariners.
Right, right.
How many missions, Reinhold, did your father go on? Did he get to be deployed? Was he deployed? Are you there? Are you still there, Reinhold? I'm not hearing
him. Oops. Nope. Me neither.
One more. Oh, all right. He's gone. Okay. Well, you're in touch with him. He'll be in touch with you. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go over to Texas now and say hello to Lowell. Hello, Lowell. Welcome to the program. Haven't heard anyone named Lowell for a long time. Great name.
Yeah, I'm here.
Welcome. What can we do for you?
Hello. I have a question for Harry.
Uh-huh.
I've read his books, seen his DVDs. Well, my question goes back to earlier you were talking about his children.
Okay.
And in the book, Don Angel was telling about a mission that he had.
Yep.
Where he went to visit Hitler, and Hitler was most interested in a couple of children. I think it was in Las Cruces, New Mexico.
That's correct. The boy was Adolfo,
was
and the daughter was and the girl was Stern. Right.
I never understood what, if any, relationship he had to those children, or what.
All right. Well, Harry will think about that. We have to hit this break, Lowell. Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
We'll come back and get a response from Harry Cooper about that very interesting question. Allegedly, a boy and a girl in New Mexico, perhaps the children of Adolf and Ava. Be right back.
Yeah.
Hold on. Okay, let's get right back to the program, and Lowell is standing by. All right, Harry, what do you have for this?
Yeah, that's a very interesting part of the book, and as much as I know about it is in the book. When Don Angel was in Mexico City working for the Reich, one of his main objectives was to check in on two children who are going to school in Las Cruces, New Mexico. The boy was named Adolfo, and the girl was named Stern, which is the German word for star. And Don Angel never knew who these kids were or why he was supposed to keep track of them. And then when he was sent down to meet with Hitler in 1952, September, he was told to bring that file with him. And like I say, he said in the book that he was landing in Antarctica, but I put an editor's note in there that we believe that's disinformation. He was landing at the estate where he lived after the war.
In Bariloche, and, yeah.
Yeah, right, in Bariloche. Because Bariloche is far enough south to where September, it would be just absolutely snow-covered because that's the dead of winter down there. Actually, their seasons are reversed. He gave the report to Hitler, and he said Hitler was very interested in it, and he asked one or two questions, and then that was it. Don Angel was dismissed, and he flew back. Who were the children? We can only guess. Through our friend Pam, we met the gentleman who was superintendent of schools for Las Cruces, about 10 years ago, I guess it was. And he went back, you know, nothing was computerized in the 1950s. He went back looking for, he had only the first names, and he was not successful to find Adolfo or Stern. We are still digging into it. We can make our assumptions who they were, but we don't have anything firm.
It would make sense, Harry, if they happened to be Hitler's children, that the U.S. government would expunge all records of them, especially that far back in school, so no one could trace it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably true, and that's probably the way it happened, but until we have hardcore proof, I can't say that's what did happen. But that was a good question, Lowell, and one of the great newscasters of our time.
Lowell Thomas.
Lowell Thomas, yep. That was back when they were newscasters and not mouthpieces for the lamestream media, but let's not get off on that.
Ken,
well,
and
I hope that,
Ken and Barbie.
I hope that answers your question there. That's as much as I know about it.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
Okay, Lowell.
Something that when I read it, I always wondered about it.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. You mentioned also the oil fields in Romania.
About
a little while ago.
OSD. Yep.
And my uncle that I was named after, he piloted, it was the Liberator.
B-24.
He flew 52 missions over those fields.
Wow.
Right. That would mean he was either in the 98th or the 307th bomb wing.
That's a lot
he flew
of missions.
Out of that little country, Morocco.
Yeah, I know that because I was in the 98th bomb wing.
I see.
You know, years after the war, but the 307th and the 98th were always together on their bases, and or at least when I was in, they were, and it was those two bomb wings that were attacking Ploesti.
Wow. Okay, Lowell, thank you. We've got it.
In 2009.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you very
you
much.
Bet.
And thank you, both of you, for all you're doing here. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate you, Lowell. Thank you.
Righto.
Okay. Mike in Pennsylvania is on the air. You there, Mike?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to add a couple of things and wanted to thank Mr. Cooper. I recently purchased his book, and I'm salivating, waiting on receipt of the book. I've been also following on the History Channel their take on how Hitler got out of Germany.
Oh, that comedy show, yeah.
Yes, yes. But what I found interesting, I'm an Air Force veteran, and I was stationed in Spain in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
And it was funny that on more than one occasion while I was over there, in southern Spain, I don't know if you're familiar with Torremolinos, Spain, but there were
a lot of Germans there.
And on more than one occasion, I heard that, and this goes back to 1969, that Hitler had gotten out of Germany. Now, not knowing anything at the time, thinking where are they pulling this from, it was I found rather interesting. And then we he started researching this further when I saw this on the History Channel, and then I got hooked up with the Shark Hunters, and I got, I don't know if I got your email or not, but I just received the KB-276.
Oh, yeah, that's the most current issue of the magazine.
Correct, and I think that was from you, and then I got an email saying that they, you were going to be on the air tonight, so I just
right.
wanted to say hello, and look forward to reading the book. Also,
well, you'll be reading it pretty quick, because we just about ran the local post office out of stamps here in the last, well, this whole week we've been taking boatloads of books to the post office here, and they're happy to see us because they their cash register keeps ringing because we keep shipping them books. And they all went out. Every last book order we had is filled, and it's going by priority mail. So even though it's Christmas rush, you should have it within. Well, you should have. We hope you have it before Christmas, but within the next week, you'll have it in your hands.
That's great, because I'm one of these kind of people that once I pick up a book, if I find it interesting, and I'm sure this will be, I won't put it down until I'm done with it.
Yeah.
And then I can
darn near guarantee you, you won't put it down. Right.
Yeah.
Because after the first half of the book, which is the whole story, then there are photos and FBI files, not the ones that the guys on Hunting Hitler have gotten, because they just got declassified last year. We got those same files about 6 or 7 years ago. Again, we have our network, and one of them had an in there with the Phoebes, the FBI, and we referred to him as Agent Tauker, with a German word Tauker means diver, and he was diving into all the files, and we got all those files 6, 7 years ago.
Wow.
Well, speaking of divers, both my wife and I are divers, and we've had the opportunity to actually dive on a sunken German U-boat off the coast of North Carolina, the U-352.
Oh, 352, yeah. The skipper and several of the crew were members of Shark Hunters till they passed away.
God
and
bless
boy,
them.
Talk about a reincarnation of the Bounty. They absolutely hated the skipper. They were having a boat reunion, a Bootsbesatzung in Charleston, I think it was. And they sent a letter to the captain and told him he was not only not invited, but he would be thrown out if he showed up.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Now, when the boat sunk, I'm getting the impression that much of the crew was able to escape.
A large part of the crew did escape. Some of the crew, I don't have the figures in front of me, but the skipper and several others did escape. And the boat went down in shallow water.
You can get to the sand. She sits. You can get to the conning tower at about 80 feet, and then it sits in the sand at about 105 feet.
Right. Yeah. And, it's visited through the whole summer months, I guess, by dive operators.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But I think it was a situation where you had not only an overly tough skipper, but crew who didn't take discipline very well. They referred to the skipper as the czar. And there was one time he was up in the conning tower setting up a shot. And from down below in the central control room, he heard somebody's voice. "Have you seen your Knight's Cross yet?" You know, they were taunting him. And then he was setting up on a ship, and they flood down forward to compensate for the loss of the torpedo, and the kid on the controls screwed up, and he flooded down aft, and the boat sank out of control. It only bottomed out in about 100 feet. Didn't hurt the boat, but it ruined his shot. So he confined that kid to the electric motor room, which is the hottest, smelliest part of the boat. He had to sleep on the floor plates, take his meals on the floor plates, and nobody was allowed to talk to him. And as soon as he got back to port, he was handed over to the military police, and nobody ever saw the kid again.
Wow, what a story.
History.
Well, that's the stuff we dug out in our history here.
Yeah, that's another great one. Fascinating. The boat, what does the boat look like, Mike? How did it sink, Harry?
Well,
it was depth charged and straight by a cutter.
Cutter got it with a depth charge. Okay.
What happened was
it was the Coast Guard cutter Icarus.
correct, missed, and they got a bead on it, and they depth charged it. It came up, and they just raked it with submachine gun fire. And there are seven crew members, I believe, still interned on it. A friend of ours, who we knew that discovered it, actually a few years back. Well, it's more than a few years now. Back, George Purifoy had...
George Purifoy, sure. He was a member of Shark Hunters, too, until he got divorced, and I think things went upside down for him.
He was a great guy, I'll tell you.
Yeah,
we had the opportunity to dive with him just before he died. But
What did the boat look like, Mike? How much of it... You could just see the conning tower, you say?
The pressure hull's intact, okay? The conning tower and a number of the plates are still on the section of the submarine forward of the conning tower.
Uh-huh.
And aft, you have the cannon mount is still there. They removed the cannon off of it, and a lot of the outer plates are gone. You still have the ribbing there, and you can actually do penetrations in it, although I wouldn't recommend it. I know people that have done penetration dives. In the U-boat.
That's risky.
A friend of mine went in the galley, opened up the oven, and there was a beautiful white plate that he brought back out, and he has on display. He's got a number of things on display in his dive shop in King Spring, Pennsylvania.
That's extraordinary. Mike, we're out of time. Thank you for calling and sharing that wonderful linkage with Harry and Shark Hunters. That's amazing.
Yeah, you remind me tomorrow, Jeff, and I can send you photos of the boat as it sits underwater.
That'd be interesting. Very good. Mike, thank you for calling again. Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas, Mike.
Well, Mr. Cooper, that was a remarkable program. We got all of our callers in, and some very interesting and alert folks out there are right on top of this. And the more they read, the better they're going to be.
Oh, yeah, they can go to sharkhunters.com. Also, one sad thing about U352, another dive shop right after George Purifoy found it, another dive shop went out and removed a bunch of bones and was selling the bones.
Come on.
But they were put out of business very quickly.
So yeah, good.
We can, your listeners, just send me an email, sharkhunters@earthlink.net, and say they heard the show, and we'll send them a free issue of the KTV magazine electronically.
Wonderful. Okay, my friend, Merry Christmas to you, to your family, and I hope you have a wonderful time and just rest up, and looking forward to your next discoveries, as always. Amazing.
Yeah. Getting ready to go in February. Okay. All right. Merry Christmas to you too, my friend, and
thanks,
all the troops there at the station.
Okay. Thanks much. Take care.
Righto. Good night.
Good night. Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. Thanks for all you callers. We appreciate that. And fascinating 2 hours of real history. And we shall continue.